So let's look at that in terms of a method. The starting point, as with most things, is the problem, because people will come to you with a problem if they want change, and typically they'll be fixated on it anyway, because that's why they have a problem. Okay? Good to have that, because remember from the previous masterclasses, the problem is already a fixation of attention, which already opens a doorway to hypnosis. So you already have a hypnotic element, a hypnotic door opening to you. The problem is a good place to start, and one of the ways to start already shifting from a problem, remember we're talking about shifting attention. So how do you shift from the problem while still pacing the problem so that you're not ignoring it? Well, ask a question that presupposes the attention to go somewhere else. For example, what do you want to work through today? Or what do you want to resolve right now? These kinds of questions are implying that the problem will soon no longer be. That's a great place to start from. In itself, it's not going to make the changes. But if you start with an implication that nothing's going to happen, for example, what are you going to work on? You know, what's your problem? These are all things that are implying what you're going to work on implies that you're not going to get finished. What is your problem implies that there is a solid thing and it's not going to necessarily move. So you're already starting with your orientation question. Although it orients towards the problem, you're already attaching it with a piggyback suggestion through implication that says this problem is temporary and it will pass. If you do this elegantly, of course, they'll accept the presupposition because they want to talk about the problem, and the unconscious mind, in accepting the presupposition, will make it easier for you to make shifts later on. It's just one of the things that you do to ease your way into it. Do you kind of understand why we begin in this particular way and the kind of questions you can ask to begin to loosen the grip of the problem up a little bit without being too obvious about it?
Yes.
Okay. So then what happens? In fact, let me ask you, how many people on this call have done change work, hypnotherapy, coaching, anything like that with other people, or at least attempted to do it?
Yep.
Yeah, David and Sean. So those of you who've done some change work, let me ask you this. What happens when you start asking about the problem? Do they lay it out to you neatly? Is it easy to get a grip and know exactly what to do? What typically happens?
I mean, the most obvious thing about it is that they're locked into it.
They get locked into it, right? And in terms of what kind of stuff they say to you, I mean, do you say, you know, what's your problem? Do they come out with a clear definition of the problem, or do they kind of hum and haw and say, well, it's this, but it's kind of that, and it's the other thing, and you know, like, I kind of have this sometimes problem sometimes, then come to think of it, I have a problem there as well, and it's there, and I kind of want to solve this thing. Does this begin to sound a little bit familiar?
I suppose in the main, the thing that strikes me is that people come with I suppose, a story.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose I've kind of moved away a little bit from it because I'm no longer willing to deal with the story.
Excellent.
Because of the very obvious thing you said about the presupposition you're going to fix it. Because if you distract them from their story,
mm-hmm.
then actually there's a new state. And it's a state of going to succeed. And even though they may not wholly feel it at that point, it is a different state because that they kind of learn there's a different set of rules. A lot of people come with the idea that, you know, here's my problem, I've told all these people and it's failed. And so the first thing I want to do is actually distract them from it. Because
excellent.
Go forward.
Now, David, you've got obviously quite a bit more experience than some other people on this call. So let me ask you this. If you weren't to do what you've just described, if you did listen to their story, what happens? What is the danger of listening to their story?
I suppose the obvious thing is that somewhere in my mind, I kind of think that what they're saying is valid.
So it sucks you in.
And also, I miss the solution. Because I suppose the one big thing I've learned is that everyone knows the solution, they just don't know they know the solution.
Absolutely. Now, consider this. What is it that happens that allows you as a hypnotist, a particular one with a lot of experience, to be sucked into their problem, into their reality where the problem exists, when you know really that you should, that they have a resource and that they can solve it themselves. Perhaps one of the things that they're doing is they are hypnotizing you with their own problem construct. This is one of the nature of problems. And the thing is, if you let people run loose with their story, as you called it, they themselves have like a weird gray cloud where they're not quite sure where the problem begins and where it ends, and they run into an endless loop of the problem. In fact, they can never run out about things to tell you about the problem and how everything can't work and finding exceptions. It always loops back in on itself. And this is what makes problems incredibly difficult to deal with if you deal with them as a big kind of construct. This is what some people call trying to pick up the pot by the soup that's inside it. Instead, consider trying to pick up the pot by the handle, the thing, the one element that has been designed that sticks out and it's easy to grab hold of so that you can control everything else that's going on. Now, one way to do this is rather than finding reasons and excuses and descriptions and basically this whole story that David was talking about, is to drill them down to one specific context. Typically, people will give you lots of different contexts. I say, well, you know, I have a problem here, and I've got a problem here, and when I go here, I've had this, and the other day I went there and I had it, and then I went to the shops and I felt bad, and I got into the bus, and someone said this, and my mother called me up, and it happens all the time, and I'm really upset that I can't deal with this, and it seems like so overwhelming. Well, of course, it's overwhelming. They're trying to deal with everything at the same time. And there are a few things that you can deal with all at once. So, what you want to do is you want to drill them down to one specific manageable instant. In other words, he asked them, give me one specific example of the problem. So let's take an example. Someone here, give me an example of a typical problem someone might come to you with.
I get angry when I come in from work.
Okay, someone says, I'm angry when I come in from work. And you start talking to them, and then you ask them whether it's happened. They go, all the time. Like the other day, my boss told me off, and I was angry, and then I felt upset because I wasn't doing well enough. And then, you know, I'm sure it's going to happen tomorrow, and I hate my job. And by the way, you know, I'm no good at it. And, you know, these are the kind of patterns people run into. So if they get angry when they come home from work, this is a general context. You can't solve something which is abstract, there's no concreteness to it. So you can come down to one specific example, and you ask something like, "So, give me an example. When? Give me an example of a time that you actually came home and you were angry." So Sean, just role play with me for a second. What might they say if I ask that? You would say, "So, give me an example." Don't be kind, by the way.
The other day I had a meeting with my boss, which wound me up a bit. Also, I held it in because I was in work, and then when I come home, my wife, the house was a mess, and I just flipped.
Excellent. Right, so he's actually giving me two contexts there. Typically, by the way, a client will very often run on and give you five, six, seven, eight different examples, or they'll be pushed and they'll go, I can't think of one right now. Right? Those are the two typical situations. In the first, if they give you lots and lots of examples, it's basically they're telling you how they're doing the problem. They're overloading themselves with, you know, how many contexts they are incapable of, quote unquote, incapable of dealing with. And so they basically are cutting off their own resources by thinking about all the different contexts in which they can't do anything right. The other people are showing you also that they can't, the way they do the problem. The ones that can't give you a specific context basically are doing the problem so well it's unconscious. They're accessing a unconscious trance, a pathological trance, if you like, where literally their mind shuts off. They do the problem, and then their mind comes back again to deal with the aftermath. And they go, how does this happen again? So when you ask them for an example, they'll turn around and go, well, I can't give you one. That's important. You don't take them at face value. If they say it happens everywhere, and you say, well, give me an example. And you go, well, it happens everywhere. So, well, if it happens everywhere, it should be easy for you to give me an example. Just one. That's all we want, right? You want to push them for one specific example because that's where you get the power of leverage to do something. You do not want to leave it abstractly, like when Sean said, I get angry when I get home from work. You want to push it down to a specific example. In this case, it's I came home, I flipped when the house was a mess. Okay? Or I was in a meeting at work and my boss said something and I was unhappy. Those are two separate examples, and you must pin them down to one specific time, one specific place, one specific set of people, one specific instance. Does that kind of make sense so far?
Yep.
Yes.
No.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've got the problem. You've already tweaked the way you pay attention to the problem by presupposing that they're going to resolve it. You're now limiting the problem to one specific context so they don't hit overwhelm. And if they are unconscious about it, you keep asking them over and over again. And you just rephrase the question, you know, say, well, you know, if it happens everywhere, you could be an example. Just think of an example. Just one example would be fine. Okay, just one example. So notice I'm being a little bit persistent, because that persistent is basically peeling through the layers of, if you like, the veils that they've put up between their conscious attention and the unconscious automatic action of the pattern. So push them until you get a specific context. Very important. Now, the next thing that'll happen is, like Sean just gave me a very elegant example of there, they'll give you a context, but they won't give you enough information for you to know what the trigger is. You want to know what the trigger is, what sets it off. Now, we have an idea of what the trigger is. In other words, Sean comes home and he sees the place in a mess and he flips. So there is a possibility that is the visual cue, seeing the mess, that trips off the negative state. Okay? But we don't know this for sure. Why? Because in the same way, some people can literally delete all the cases of where they have a problem, they just know they have a problem and it becomes this gray mist of problemhood that they can't penetrate. In the same way, they might actually be burying the trigger and not be aware of what it is. In fact, it's usually quite common because the trigger is typically the first step into a pathological trance in which they have amnesia. So you want to listen out for what visual components, what auditory components, those are the two typical ones. Occasionally it'll be other things, but usually, almost always, it'll be something they see or something they hear, which causes them to feel a certain way, which then causes the behavior. And you want to find out, what is that trigger? So I might ask Sean, so you come home and your wife is there and the place is a mess. So tell me, what is it you saw, or what is it you heard immediately before you flipped? So do you see how I'm now narrowing the point of time very precisely? And I've actually done the same question again, just on a more tight loop. Remember, we talked about the iterative process, running the same loop over and over again. The big loop was, what's the problem that you want to resolve today? That was the first orientation question. The second loop was really asking the same question, but more precisely. So give me a specific example of that problem. It's the same question. You still ask me about the problem, but you're defining it more closely. So you're running a tighter loop. So it gives me the example of coming home on that specific evening. Now I ask about a specific point in that evening. So you've come home, what happens immediately before you flip? So Sean, what might you answer? I mean, you feel free to make this up for now, just so we can kind of role play the example a little bit.
Okay. I walked in the door and I see my wife sat on the settee, and she'd been off all day, and I looked around and the house was just a complete tip.
And then what happens? So you're coming home, you see your wife sitting on the sofa. The house is a complete tip. What happens next?
I ask her what house is a mess, and she says that she's been busy,
okay.
Which I didn't believe.
And then what happened?
And then I just started shouting.
Excellent.
I think I kicked
so,
the box.
So the shouting is kind of like the after effect of the state, which is feeling angry. So at what point did you start feeling angry? Was it when you saw your wife, when you saw the clothes? So when you asked her about why everything was a mess, what happened immediately before you started getting angry?
I think I was a little bit wound up anyway.
Okay.
And then when I walked in the house, that just triggered it off.
So literally, you open the door, you walk in the house, and you're angry.
Yeah.
Triggers off. So what happens? And by the way, guys, this is a really good example. Notice how Sean is actually running through these loops, but he's actually evading the trigger point a little bit, which is excellent. This is what happens very naturally. So you open the door, you're a little bit wound up from work anyway, you open the door, you come in, and you just flip. Or do you see something before, or do you hear something before you flip?
Usually there's a reason. Maybe
this specific time, you came home. So what day was this? Feel free to mix
it
up.
It was a Wednesday.
It was a Wednesday. So this last Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
So that Wednesday, you're coming home, you're a little bit wound up, you open the door. By the way, notice what I'm doing here to orient him to one specific context and find the trigger. I'm actually telling the story, and I'm listening, and if I was there live with Sean, I would probably be watching for it. At what point does he go unconscious? At what point does he hit that trance? And I'll see something happen. I'll hear a shift in his tone. If this is a spurious example, you probably won't hear it on this call, but if you're doing it with a real problem, you'll typically hear it. Or if you're doing it live, you'll definitely see shifts happening again. And you'll keep refining the process, just finding more information within those loops until you find what is the specific trigger. So we're coming back to this. So it's Wednesday, you're a little bit wound up from work, you open the door, you come in, and what happens immediately before, between coming in through the door and you basically flipping and starting to shout at your wife? What happens between those two points in time?
I walk in the door and there's just a load of boxes and rubbish all piled in the hallway.
Okay, so you see the boxes and of rubbish and pile in the hallway. Do you flip now?
I'm pretty angry, but I go and find my wife to see why it's still there.
Okay, so you're more angry when you see the boxes than when you walk in the door, or the same sort of anger.
I'm more angry.
Okay, so how do you know to be angry? So what I'm doing here, by the way, I'm just testing whether it's just seeing the boxes that makes him angry, which would be a visual trigger, or if he looks at the boxes and says something to himself like, "Hey, those shouldn't be there. What are they doing there?" And then that internal dialogue's making him angry. But do you see how what I'm doing now is I'm step by step deconstructing the events, and I am specifically looking for a simple piece of information. What does he see? What does he hear? In order to be able to do the problem, which is to feel angry and then start shouting at his wife. And then of course we'll go on to finding a resource state and an alternative behavior in that situation. Did you all kind of get a sense of how we're building this up? Now, ideally, what we're looking for is to get the trigger. Now, to a certain extent, even if you miss the trigger initially, because it'll take a little time for you to get more confidence in finding the triggers, it's not necessarily all is lost, because in the process of finding the trigger, you have all these little visual and auditory pieces, the boxes in the hallway, the things he says to himself, the things he says to his wife, the sofa, the mess in the house, etc. These are all specific little pieces that are all part of the problem context. Later, when you find a resource, you can bring them back to the same problem context, and all the little pieces, which kind of added together anyway, you just throw them all together, and one of them will be the trigger, but the whole thing becomes a kind of a construct. So either way, you still reorient them to the problem and helping create the solution. The elegant way, of course, is to find the one point of the trigger, but failing that, you just want to have a rich enough context so that you can always take them back to it. Do you see what I'm going with this? So you have an easy approach, which is find a sensory-rich context, which sets off the problem. And with experience, that sensory-rich context gets whittled down to a very specific trigger, something they see or something they hear immediately before they go unconscious and start having the problem. Does that kind of make sense? Now, you are looking for that moment, that point in time when they go unconscious. So, you are doing several things. Let's just go through this process, this distraction method for change again. We've got the problem. You orient towards the problem. That's your first loop, your first cycle, by asking a question that presupposes it's going to get resolved. The next step is to get a specific context. The next loop, it's the same loop really, but you're just going into more and more detail, is you begin to listen out for the trigger. What is the thing that sets off the bad feelings? Whilst you're doing this, so you're listening out for and looking for something they see or something they hear, typically. You're watching for them for what point they go unconscious. Because typically, as they're describing the whole scene to you, they will do it in front of you. There'll come a point where their eyes will maybe glaze over, they'll go somewhere else, and they'll come back, and then they'll give you part of the story again. You don't care so much about the story at this point, you care about that point at which their eyes glaze over before they come back again. And then you keep sending them back into that point whilst asking more and more orienting questions, because then you're bringing what was unconscious conscious, which is another way of shifting attention. Again, you're loosening the problem cycles by shifting attention to different places. This time you're sending the conscious mind to the places that were unconscious in order to open the space up in which you can then resolve the problem in a moment's time. Now, let's say you've got this whole bag. You have, let's say in Sean's example, something he sees the boxes and he starts getting angry. Let's say that the moment he walks in the door and sees the boxes, that's when he starts getting unconscious. And talking to Sean, I've noticed that that's the point where he begins to access the pathological trance and literally his mind goes away for a little while. We've cycled through that enough for him to start penetrating through that veil. Now I think I've got enough of the story or enough of the details I'm looking for to make a difference. Now comes the resolution phase. So now we've gone through the first phase, which is, remember, we talked about step one is the problem. That's how we look at the problem. Step two, of course, is to distract the attention. Do any of the things that we've talked about, internal external fractionation, random non sequiturs, focusing the attention on different things, on specific awarenesses, giving them information which is curious that distracts them from thinking about the other things. You basically want to break their state in any way that you can distract them in. Why? Because if they're accessing the problem construct, you want them to break some of the, you don't want them to be stuck in that negative state before you start orienting them towards solution, because it's harder to get to solutions when you're stuck in a bad state. It's just like when, if you've ever felt depressed, it's incredibly difficult to think of happy memories when you're depressed, right?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. So you need to get them out of that feeling, out of that depression, the anger, or whatever the negative state was, before you start orienting them towards solutions. So you create the distraction to do that. When elegantly done, you can literally run with the distraction straight into the resource, as you saw, for example, Sean doing in the session two. So once you've distracted them, you've broken the state, you've broken the grip of the negative state, you got to the next point. Now, the next point is you begin to search for resources. Okay? You start asking, for example, how do you want to be different? What do you want? What is it that you want to be doing instead? Now, notice that the moment I'm leaving the door open for a dirty goal, if I say, how do you want to be different? What do you want instead? How do you want to be behaving instead? What do you want to be doing instead? How do you want to be instead? These things might still be driven by the unmet need. That's okay. Remember, it's not necessarily a bad starting point as long as you don't finish there. Whatever they give you then want to test. You could literally just dive into resources and go, let's find a whole bunch of resources and attach it. You could literally do that. The elegant way, though, is to test for what is the super state? What is the state that has built into it the need that hasn't been met before, so that by the very accessing of this state, they overcome the problem or the very thing that drove the problem in the first place. Well, how do you do this? Your mission is to get to the purpose behind the goal. What is the highest intention, the purpose that drives the goal? This is where the question comes in. How would you be, or how would you be different if you no longer had the problem? How would you be different? That is not what would you be doing differently. That's a good question to ask and has useful information. But how would you be different? Being different implies a state. You are looking for a state. You want a state because you want the state to later drive the behavior. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So you always, whatever the goal they come out with, whatever outcome they come out with, you're always going to try and get behind the outcome. Whether they do this directly or indirectly is not really important at this stage, but you want what is the outcome behind it? What is it? The question you ask yourself, if they get this goal, what do they think that will give them? And if they get what they think that will give them, is that what they actually want? Right? So if they get wealthy, what do they think that will give them? Lots of attention. Is that attention what they want? Well, not necessarily. They might just want to feel loved. So feeling loved is the super state. It's not the attention, that's one of the goals, but they think that the attention will then get them that sense of being loved. And that's what you're always aiming towards. Again, you'll know you'll have it because when you get it, there is a tremendous shift. You can see the whole neurology beginning to shift with them, especially if you're going hunting after it. Now, there are certain things that can happen as you ask a question like, how would you be different if you no longer had the problem, to orient them towards a resource, particularly this super state that we've been talking about. The first thing that may happen is they may just spontaneously actually access the super state. They may go straight there. Great. If they do, you use it. Another thing that might happen is they might access a resource state, but not necessarily the super state. In other words, in the example, it might get attention. What's it like? Feel like to have attention? It feels good. Now, you can tell that they haven't lit up a whole lot. They've lit up a little bit, but they haven't quite hit the payoff yet. There's still something there. But the resource state is still a good one. So you still want to set a trigger with it because you still want to be using that resource. Now, there's separate ways you can use the resource. You could go straight back to the problem with a new resource to begin to blend it with the problem and just basically make the problem, like deviate the problem. It can't quite be the same problem anymore. Or you can build, or you can go searching for multiple resources, stack them all together, and then apply those as a thing. You can also add those resources to spontaneously, if you spontaneously find the super state later on, you can use them all together. These are all things that work together. Remember, everything you've learned so far, you can still use. Just because I'm describing a particular process doesn't mean that it's to the exclusion of everything else. The non-awareness set from one of the earlier masterclasses, storytelling, the trance of infinite possibilities, these are all devices which will spontaneously come in at this stage. These are tools of your trade. So don't neglect them just because we are focusing on the distraction method at this point and shifting attention to getting certain outcomes. To train your ability to shift outcomes, by all means, put them to one side. But it's when it's the result that counts, bring every single tool you have to bear. And that way, you will get good results. So they could spontaneously access the super state. Great, you use it. They could spontaneously access a resource state, which is not necessarily the super state. Use that as well. The third thing that might happen is they hit a kind of a blank wall. If they hit a kind of a blank wall, it's kind of a trance. Basically, they're saying, I'm now entering a trance of infinite possibilities, but no specific possibility has arisen over any other one yet. Okay? When that happens, when they hit that blank state and they're not sure which way it goes, you want to watch them very carefully, because that blank state can tip into one of two places, somewhere positive or somewhere negative. If it's kind of a blank, but they're still kind of a little bit nervous, or you can still see signs of tensions, signs of the original negative state or a different negative state, you want to take them out of that. In other words, you cycle through the whole distraction thing again, and you do this whole process again. You distract them again, you reorient again towards a resource, ideally the super state, but any resource will do for the beginning part, and then you see what happens. Either they hit the resource state, they hit the super state, or they hit another blank. Okay? So do you see how those cycles are running?
Yes.
Okay. Now, the other alternative, of course, is that the blank doesn't tip towards a negative, but it's like in a blank state, but they're pretty positive about it. What that is basically telling you is they're accessing or beginning to access unconscious resources, whilst their conscious mind has no clue what's going on. That's perfect. Exactly what you want, because you now have a resource without conscious involvement, which is exactly where you want to be heading towards. So now you have a positive tip and a positive chance of infinite possibilities. Use that, throw in resource language to begin to shape this blankness into resourceful states, and to begin ideally to start teasing out the super state, which will deal with all the ecology things in the first place. As you're doing this, of course, new outcomes, new goals and things will begin to emerge. Let them emerge spontaneously. Spontaneously, of course, means they're emerging from the unconscious mind. Because you've created the context of this resource state, though, the goals and the behaviors that they start talking about or that start emerging spontaneously are things that aren't contaminated. So you don't have the ecology issues anymore. So those are the main things that can happen as you go hunting for resources, and particularly the super state, the purpose behind the goal they're trying to achieve. Do you understand that phase of the process and the different directions that, or different responses people might give you when you hit that phase?
Yes.
Okay. So does someone want to recap very briefly the steps that we've gone through so far? We've only got halfway through the distraction method, but I want to make sure that you guys are still with the program on this. So who wants to give me a brief recap of the steps we've gone through?
I can answer that question if you like.
Go on, David.
That you actually will, let's go back, and that you use the fixation that the problem itself actually brings up. You identify, you put a presupposition in, i.e., in terms of what do they want to resolve today. Identify the trigger to a series of tighter and tighter loops until you narrow it down. In essence, what you're talking about is funneling questioning, actually,
Yes,
which is
exactly.
a technique that's often used in quite a few other areas.
Yeah.
Then you're actually breaking the state that you've just created, and then you're taking them to find their resources, which has the potential for dirty goals, and then you're actually looking for that super state. You talked about the potential for three types of reaction, really. One was to actually access the super state and use it. One is actually you just identify a positive resource, in which case you build on that to get that super state, or you could just get a blank, which has a potential for positive or negative. If it's negative, you go back to the loops. If it's positive, you take them forward and allow a super state to evolve, which I had a question about.
Excellent. Go
And
ahead.
my question was really about, I suppose, in a sense, the thing you didn't mention, I wanted to check it was that, was about timing is the key here. And it seemed to me that there's a kind of contradiction there because it's a process. But actually, the thing perhaps is most important, it seemed to me, and that's what I wanted to check, particularly for the last stage, was timing, to allow enough time for it to happen.
Yes. You want to have states emerging, so you want to leave gaps for processing. So whenever we talk about cycles, what you're basically doing is, the way I think of it is, you've got a pebble, you're throwing it into the pond. The pebble is the attention. You throw it into the pond in terms of the questions you're asking or where you're orienting their attention towards, and then you watch the ripples emerge and see what emerges. And you let natural things come out. Now, when something emerges, you'll get one of those three responses you just talked about. You're not pushing those things to emerge. The only time that you may want to push something is when they're in the blank state, but then you're not really pushing it. You're beginning to tweak it. You leave them a few moments for that, in that blankness, to see which way it goes, and then you begin to shape it with your language towards a resource if they're not already coming towards something. If they're going towards something negative, you go back into a distraction loop. Either way, you're letting them spontaneously emerge with a response, and that takes as long as it takes. So some people take a little longer, some people take a little shorter. So you're absolutely right. The timing is dictated by them rather than by yourself.
I also had another question. It was when you were talking about the problem state, something which I flirted with, and it's got some usages, which is to actually use, I mean, as you said, it is the gateway to hypnosis. And sometimes it's actually quite useful to use it. And I just wondered what you thought about that, because in a sense, if you use it, and you take it into resources and take it into a positive, there is a kind of collapsing anchor taking place, if that makes sense.
So, how do you mean using the problem to find resources?
I mean, there's some things that I perhaps wouldn't initially do it with, things like, somebody started working with somebody with depression, perhaps it's not the greatest idea in the world. But there are some situations where when somebody talks about their feelings, that you use their feelings as the gateway to hypnosis, and you take them into hypnosis as a starting of the problem, it just becomes a continuation, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. So what you're doing is you're staying within the same almost logical level as the problem, but you're still shifting the attention from the problem itself towards something else which is in the same ballpark as a problem, right?
And I suppose the ultimate lesson, I suppose, that you're, are you teaching them or are they teaching you? I suppose is a moot point in some ways, but actually what they're learning is that they can control their own states from wherever they begin from.
Absolutely right. And I think that's one of the crucial pieces that people need to learn, which is managing their own states. So, yes, this is one of the like meta patterns that they get used to. The more you help people, well, here's one of the things that happens when you do change with people. You're training them in a process of how to deal with change in a positive way. So that the more they make changes with you, eventually the mind just goes, hang on a second, I know how to do this, and then they make more of those changes themselves. In other words, at some point you no longer become necessary, which is perfect. It goes right back to the example of the iterations we've been talking about today, where once you've run the same process enough times, the mind generalizes, it takes the pattern and runs with it on its own, at which point you're no longer necessary, which I think is a great place to be. Absolutely right there, David. You're bang on the topic. So let's look at the final parts then of the distraction method. So far we've gone through a couple of cycles towards getting a resource and orienting it in a context, which is the change that we're doing. Now, let's say you've got the resource, be it the super state or a normal resource. The next thing you want to do is take that resource back towards the trigger that you spent so much time finding in the first place, the trigger for the problem, right? The thing they see or the thing they hear. Or the whole context itself, throw in the various little triggers you've dug up, the boxes, the wife sitting on the table, on the sofa, the mess around there. When you take it back to the context, you want to take the resource back to it. So whilst you're feeling the resource, you reorient their mindset. As you're feeling this, what about how do you feel about the boxes now? Right? Now, when you reorient them back to the original trigger for the problem, you'll again have a few possible responses. They might say something like, well, they might actually say nothing. They may, for a second or two, kind of be in a half and half state. In other words, they're not quite hitting the resource, they're not quite hitting the problem. If that happens, just jog them along a little bit by triggering the resource again. Remember we said before, when you find a resource spontaneously, set a trigger for it so that you can access it or use it again later. The trigger can be a tone of voice, a gesture, a touch, a word, or ideally use their own words back at them. And so let's say the resource is feeling great in that tonality. So then you go take back to the trigger. You say, so you walk into that, you walk into the house a little bit, maybe a little bit annoyed. You see those boxes, and you're not even feeling great at the opportunity you have of doing things differently at house. So you've added the reframe right at the back of the trigger for the resource. And that's actually followed the trigger for the problem. So now the chain is problem trigger actually triggers the resource trigger, triggers a reframe in behavior state, etc. Do you see how that chain works? So if they're ambivalent, if after a few seconds the resource state doesn't emerge spontaneously, you may want to help it along. Just think of it as training wheels by firing the trigger yourself. And all that tells you is you have to come back to the same trigger a few times before it's taking naturally. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
Yep.
you'll know that you've done that enough, or you won't need to do this, that cycle, when they spontaneously, automatically go into the resource state as soon as you hit the negative trigger, the problem trigger. So you say, so you're opening the door, you're coming home, you open the door, you see there's boxes everywhere, your wife's sitting on the table. How do you feel? And I'll go, well, actually, I feel quite good. I feel great. So they still have the resource. At this point, you begin to cement in the fact that there's something happening by getting to acknowledge the change. So you're seeing them in the same state whilst the box is there. So you say, and you look at the boxes, and they're going to the resource state, or they're still in the resource state, and say, how are you feeling now? And I go, it's weird, but I feel great. Now you've collapsed the problem and the resource. Okay? At this point, you can just test it. In other words, do the same context once or twice just to make sure that it's still running naturally. Or you may want to hit the other trigger points. So it could be the boxes, it could be the wife sitting on the sofa, it could be the mess behind the sofa. It could be all these different things. So you've basically taken the sting out of each of these little trigger points. I need to start finding other contexts in terms of other situations in the past. You know, the time that the boss shouted at them early on in the day and he felt a bit miffed coming out of work. Other situations in the past when it's happened. But you get him to describe those situations and bring those resources to that. So you're running those cycles through more and more and more situations. Constantly, of course, you are getting them to find more and more context. And you say, so this is great. So you're feeling great. You're walking home and all these things happen. And even though you know, despite what happened in the past, you're now feeling great. What other places do you want to feel great like that? I mean, what other places do you used to have the problem in the past and yada yada? So they go, well, you know, when a boss shout at me, bang. Now you do the same, you fire the trigger again, and you do the cycle until that feels great. And you find another situation and another situation and another situation. Now, at some point, again, one of two things will happen. At some point, they'll either say, I can't think of anything else. When they're telling you they can't think of anything else, basically, they're beginning to exhaust the pattern. Excellent. Still push at least three or four more cycles through that, because either they generally can't think of anything else, and it becomes kind of funny. They'll start laughing. I mean, you can laugh with them. You can sort of institute how, isn't it crazy? Like, you can't think of any problem, and are you sure there used to be a problem? So kind of making fun a little bit of the problem itself, until the point where they're laughing at the fact that they can't come up with any more of the problem. They had a convincing demonstration that the problem has disappeared. Alternatively, by pushing through three, four, five little cycles, despite that they can't think of any situations, they suddenly remember something they haven't mentioned yet. That's exactly what you want to happen, because these are like slightly buried patterns, the very ones that might come later on in life and sabotage it anyway. So they're, if you like, an extra layer of unconsciousness. And to get at them, it's like everything else, you just cut through the layers until you get there. Then when you find it, you do the same thing you've been doing anyway. In other words, you add resources to it until it collapses, until it's all been cleaned out. And you go back to the exhaustion until they literally cannot think of anything more. Now, occasionally what happens, somewhere along this process, it could be right at the beginning or it could be during one of the iterations, you'll hear the yes but, the dreaded yes but. Like they're saying, so how do you feel now? It was, I feel great, but there's still this problem, right? So typically what that means is there is a structure to the problem. There are layers, and you just peeled off the first layer. Now, some people might think, oh Christ, now I feel bad because they've got another problem, but they haven't really acknowledged the first problem's disappeared yet. But don't be disheartened, because remember, all change, it just goes through natural cycles, and they've just given you a starting point for the next cycle. So when they give you a yes but, you go, fantastic, high five, you've done the first one, and you take the very content that they've given you, which is the but, and you run the whole cycle through the but. So all you're doing is you're running loops or cycles within cycles within cycles until everything just runs smoothly. Think of it as a clockwork mechanism that's got a little bit jammed because some of the clockwork mechanisms have become dirty. And as soon as you free up one set of wheels and it's all nice and clean and runs smoothly, you suddenly notice that the other wheels that didn't need to bother moving before, as they start moving, some bit of dirt is in them and that's slowing things down. So you now focus on that wheel and then the next one and the next one until all the clockwork mechanism has been cleaned out. This is like the testing and reinforcing element. Does that kind of make sense in terms of the kind of the cycle structure you're going through?
Sure does.
Okay. Now there's a couple of other things that I just want to make sure that you do in the course of doing these things I've been describing. Remember, when the resource, or better still, the superstate is being triggered automatically, at that point, you want to drill them down into specific things, right? It's not enough that he sees the boxes and feels good or feels okay about it. To make it concrete, you must follow up with some kind of behavioral pattern that results out of it. The behavior in the first place was he asks his wife some suspicious questions and then shouts at her. Now, whilst he's in the resource state, so you see those boxes, how are you feeling now? And he goes, actually, I feel okay. And you go, well, as you're feeling okay, how do you want to deal with this now? How do you want to respond now? What do you want to do now? Now, that word now is very, very important. It's one of the most powerful words in your hypnotic arsenal, because now implies so many things. It implies that now things will be different to before. So whilst it's in the resource state, you are getting them to commit to either a small action for the future. So, you know, next time this thing happens, how will you be responding to it now? Or you're getting alternative behaviors for the past situation, which basically creates a reference experience for the future. So as you see those boxes and you're feeling okay or you're feeling great, how do you want to deal with the situation now? Or what do you feel like spontaneously doing now? So you bring it down to a behavioral element to give them choices. Ideally, you want to have several choices in one environment. They might come up spontaneously. Well, you know, I might come over there and just gently say, hey, I'd appreciate it if you did, you know, do the cleaning whilst I was up. Or, hey, I've suddenly realized that she has had a bad day too, so maybe she needs a little bit of love, and I'll go over there and give her a big hug. Or, you know, I'll sit down next to her and we'll watch TV, and then maybe later on we'll do the house together. So now they spontaneously come up with behaviors, many behaviors, multiple behaviors, that replace the original problem behavior. But because they're now being driven by the resource state, or better still, the super state, the one that has the unmet need being met, you take care of all ecology now. And if you do this through all the cycles that we've been talking about, you're basically getting the unconscious mind to generate new behaviors based on a clean goal and state in each different context. So you're now ingraining step by step, you're drawing a line and you're furrowing inside the brain, inside the neurology, the pattern for the positive states, for positive outcomes, behaviors and states going hand in hand to form a concrete, very real thing in the mind, which becomes as deeply rooted as the problem used to be. And that means that in the future, they have as much, if not more, ability to hit the solution, the true solution, than they had with the problem, at which point they are free. The whole purpose here, remember, is to go through as many experiences in the past and then maybe even in the future that they can think of, as you can find. You keep pushing until they run out of things to say, then you push a little bit more, just to be sure. If nothing comes up, you're done. If something comes up, you keep running through those new cycles until literally nothing can come up anymore. Now, you're done. Now you've tested, and it's very unlikely that that piece of work will get undone again. Now, notice how most of the cycles that we've been talking about are actually spent on that last part, that testing cycle, that reinforcing part of the cycle. You might very well get the change within the first 10, 15 minutes. In fact, typically, in many coaching contexts or hypnotherapeutic contexts, if you're taking your case history properly, you may find, or a lot of people will spontaneously have resolved the problem in the first 15 minutes, and then the minute they go, okay, let's do a change technique, and they go into back the series mode and get the conscious fixation of attention back to fixate on the problem, they actually recreate the problem again after having resolved it already. Why? Because they've trained the attention, rather they've let the conscious mind get fixated again before they've gone through any of the solution cycles. So these solution cycles actually will be taking up most of the session. If you take 10, 15, 20 minutes to do the change, you probably take 20, 30, 40 minutes to do the cycles. In reality, it'll probably take you about half an hour to do the whole lot, maybe an hour. But do you see the balance point? The balance is always towards the testing side, the reinforcement side, rather than the change side. Getting change is relatively easy. It's reinforcing the change. It's integrating the change. It's cementing and rooting the change. That is where the true skill lies, where the true challenge lies. And when you become good at doing that, your ability to become influential and persuasive in general becomes virtually limitless. Now, this is a pretty sophisticated process that we've been talking about. So let me just throw the lines open to everyone. Do you kind of understand that process and how it fits in with all the other things we've talked about so far, both in this session and the other sessions?
Yes.
Okay. Any questions, any comments so far, any ideas about how you might want to use this?
Igor, if obviously, like with me, my sessions last typically an hour.
Mm-hmm.
If when you keep going through different cycles, could this go on and on and on? Or do you find, you know, it typically takes about 20 minutes?
Well, you know, it depends on the nature of the problem and the person. Some pings are bigger than others. So typically, this is one of the reasons you want to take the initial context and confine it to a very specific thing. You expand to other contexts afterwards until the mind can generalize. If as you're getting close to the first hour, you find that you haven't managed to exhaust all the different related contexts, not things that are like problems which are similar in other contexts, but where they had specific problems in the past and the future, right? You should hit after a few cycles the point where they're literally laughing their heads off, or just going into more and more positive states, or just thinking the whole thing's really silly in a very positive way, as you just bring up more and more issues like, and what about this thing when you were younger and 5 years and 10 years and whatever? And they go, ah, it's all not a big deal. It's all fun. It's just, you know what I mean? If you could reach that point, then you're fine, really. However, if you don't quite reach that point yet, if there are still things that you need to kind of nudge them through resolving, in other words, it's a bigger issue, there are a couple of things you can do. Go back to the Power Loops masterclass. And in the Power Loops masterclass, we talked about, for example, continued process loops. A continued process loop is a bit of hypnotic language you plug in at the end of a session to basically say, unconscious mind, we're coming up to the close of this session. You've been doing great stuff. So basically, keep doing these things on your own between now and the next session. So that unconsciously, while you're dreaming, while you're sleeping, you continue to explore different situations in which you used to have this the old problem, which is how my language is directionalizing in a different direction. But now you can feel great instead, to prove to yourself that you're finally free from this. Find all the situations in the past and in the future to have total freedom, something along those lines. So you're now getting the unconscious mind to keep doing that process between sessions, and you get them, of course, come back for another session. And in the other session, you test and test and test and test and test and test until they're really done. And it might take several things. I mean, for bigger things, like if someone is really depressed, not mildly unhappy, but has depression, it's not going to happen. You're not going to do this in one session. You're going to take a specific context that gets them depressed, and you're going to pull them out of that one. In the next session, you'll pull them out of another one. So when I say reiterations and testing, it may not all happen in the same session. It may be such a big problem that you literally only have time in one session to deal with one very specific context and pop that specific context, and you can't jump into other contexts yet. But that's what the second session, the third session, the fourth session are about. That's part of how you develop, if you like, a plan, a therapeutic plan for how to deal with that particular client. So that all depends on the size of the issue, the rootedness of the issue. But all we're really doing, talking about here now, is scaling the same model either over several sessions or down to one session, right? If it's one session, you have processes like the power loops for automatically doing the same process again, for continuing the process outside of the therapy practice, etc., to help you when you're running out of time. But that's to tie up little problems. If it's so much that it requires two, three, four more sessions, so be it. Remember, who said that you have to solve everything right now in a moment? Does that answer your question, Sean?
Yeah, that's fine. So I just want to make sure that you could do this over multiple sessions, if you know
Oh,
what I mean. So,
absolutely. Yes.
great.
So the model I've given to you in terms of a one session model, just because it's easy to conceptualize, but the iterative process element of it is something you'll do maybe over several sessions until the unconscious mind gets the pattern and no longer has the meta problem. A lot of times people say, well, I get distracted from work, or I have problem with my doing my taxes, or I get frightened around my boss, I get shy around girls. These are all possibly things that are driven by the same meta issue, the same unmet need kind of feeds into all of these. So as you then deal with each one of them in turn, it might take five, it might take six, it might take a dozen, it might take 20, until the unconscious mind generalizes that meta pattern. And then as that resolves, they then get into this wonderful state of being where life just flows naturally. Life is good, which is really where they want to be. That's where natural personal power begins to emerge. So yes, Sean, depending on what it is and what the issues presenting are, you can do it in one session or several sessions, scale it according to your therapeutic instinct. Any other comments or questions so far? Well, I'll take this as a good sign that you have absorbed these materials. And remember, we've been covering a pretty gritty subject in the course of this masterclass. And I wanted to really look at that because it is actually a very important and very sophisticated way of looking at any hypnotic process. Now, just because we've been focusing on using attention as our tool, or rather distraction of attention as our tool for achieving these outcomes, does not mean that all the other tools are no longer necessary. Remember, these are all things that support and help each other and take you in different directions. As a hypnotist, you want to have many different tools for achieving similar things to give you choice, to give you the ability to work in different environments and achieve different things. So, with that happy thought, I'm going to encourage you to just go out there and spread the love. Use these techniques with your friends, with your families, do some coaching sessions with people, run through these cycles, or in the process of negotiations or talking to people, notice how these cycles naturally occur and realize that you don't have to go for the jugular straight away. Sometimes it's the right thing, and sometimes it's just following that natural flow of processes, round and round and round again, just until everything takes care of itself. It's just like those grains of rice on a chessboard. The very first grains of rice, they don't do very much because, you don't get to feed someone's hunger with one or two grains of rice. But by the time they move 4, 6, 12 squares across, you go from a bowl of rice to two bowls of rice to four bowls of rice to so much rice that the person can't even eat it. And that's the beauty of using natural cycles, the iterative process where you take a bit of change and you apply change on change itself until it grows beyond your wildest dream. That is when you use things like the butterfly effect in the context of influence, persuasion, and change to get exactly what you want from the unconscious mind pretty much every single time. So with that happy thought, I'd like to thank you all again for paying careful attention, both consciously and those delightful unconscious minds. And I'd like to suggest that perhaps over the course of the next few days, as you go to bed at night and dream, you'll have pleasant dreams, dreams that remind you about hypnotic abilities that you may not have thought about in a long, long time. Now, in the process that you go through inside those dreams, you may discover that you didn't know about all the different ways that hypnotic skills you've had in the past feed into the things you've just discovered, to not just make the things you've discovered easier, but to enrich them and make them even better. So, with those happy thoughts, allow your unconscious mind to dream of new hypnotic experiences for you, so that when you wake up refreshed every morning, you find your own hypnotic power increasing in normal everyday situations, as well as those situations in which you really want to succeed with hypnosis. With that delightful thought, I will leave you and look forward to speaking with you again on a future masterclass. Until then, goodbye for now.